Brethren, if you go ahead and turn to Exodus chapter 14 with me this morning. This is a truly significant day here on the last day of unleavened bread, as I hope you will see. I have a message prepared for you that I hope I can give you something meaningful for this day. This day, in fact, is a paradigm against which all of God's redemptive and saving work was measured this particular day. Joshua pointed to it, the prophets of old did, the New Testament writers also did, and all of them consistently pointed to the event on this day as the example of God's deliverance for us. By Jewish tradition, this is the day that Israel crossed the Red Sea. But before we get to that, let's go back and I want to read a little bit about Israel and what they were up against when they fled Egypt. So here we are in Exodus chapter 14. And you'll remember that the Israelites had left the city of Ramses on that night to be much observed, the evening of the 15th of Abib. And they had all traveled to Ramses from Goshen all around to depart Egypt. And the Pharaoh, upon the death of the firstborn, had called Moses and Aaron by night. Doesn't mean that they actually went there, but he sent a message to them and he told them to get out. And so we think there were about 3 million or so Israelites that went on their way. And they had left Ramses, as it says in Exodus 12, and they traveled to Succoth to camp. And then from there they went to Etham at the edge of the wilderness. And at that point, they were just about gone. They were just about ready to leave Egyptian soil. They were about ready to leave the clutches of the Egyptians. But God told Moses to turn south. Apparently from away from the land that they were promised to receive, away from the freedom which they sought, away from the clutches of the Egyptians, God was leading them into an apparent dead end. In Exodus chapter 14 and verse 1, we read, "Now the Eternal spoke to Moses, saying, Speak to the children of Israel that they turn and camp before Pi-hahiroth between Migdol and the sea, opposite Baal-zephon, and you shall camp before it by the sea." And so Israel is to camp here at Pi-hahiroth, which is an apparent dead end. The sea was before them, mountains on either side of them, and unbeknownst to them at the time, there was an enemy at their back that was soon to be there, and they were trapped. They were trapped, and the only way out, really, was from above, from which their salvation was to come. I have some principles for you today. I have 4 principles that I'd like to provide for you. And principle number one is this. Principle number one, God will sometimes position us in such a way that our deliverance from sin is for His glory and His honor. Well, actually, isn't it always for His glory and His honor? It always is. Everything points to Him. You know, sometimes God will put us in a position to make His glory known for all of mankind. And God planned to do this right here. God knew what was going on. He knew that they were going to feel trapped in. You know, in the movie, Cecil B. DeMille's version of the movie, The Ten Commandments, Pharaoh says, well, their God is a, what does he say? He says something like, their God is a poor general. He traps them in with the sea in front of them and the mountains on their side. He doesn't know what he's doing. But yet, if you looked at this as a chess match, God was well in advance. He understood what was going on. Years in advance, he understood what was happening. And God sometimes raises difficulties in the way of salvation of His people so that God can have the glory in subduing the difficulties and helping His people over the trial. It may be, brethren, that we go through trials where we feel boxed in, where we don't feel like there's a way out. And I appreciated Mr. McAlexander's sermonette, just a fantastic, inspiring sermonette this morning. But God simply orchestrated the situation here so that our deliverance or theirs was for the glory of God, for His glory, for His purpose, so that His glory would be known throughout all the nations around them. And we are simply an instrument in His orchestral arrangement that He uses for His will to be accomplished, to play His beautiful music. I'd like you to turn to John chapter 9. In John chapter 9, we see in the Gospel according to John a story about a man who was given a very special condition. We see a man who was born blind from birth. John chapter 9 and verse 1, "And Jesus passed by," it says, "and he saw a man which was blind from his birth. And his disciples asked him, saying, Master, who did sin, this man or his parents, that he had been born blind? And Jesus answered, neither has this man sinned nor his parents, but that the works of God should be made manifest in his flesh, or in him. What an orchestration of events that had to have occurred for this to come about, for this to have happened here. We think about God had orchestrated all the events in this man's whole life so that this event right here would come about, so that we could read about it today. You know, we don't know how old this man was. He clearly seemed to be of age. Some have speculated in the commentaries that maybe he was 13, about the time of the bar mitzvah when Jews go through that process. I think he was probably older, and some commentaries do. There's the age of 30, which seems to be an age of maturity in Jewish culture as well. But this man could reason, as you can read later. He could reason. He answered the Pharisees. He talked to Jesus. His parents said, well, ask him. He's of age. So I think that he was probably a little bit older. Could have been 20 to 30 years old. But he wasn't a boy. And this entire life, he lived without sight. He lived without seeing. He had not seen anything. And I think it's interesting, the perspective that you take going through life. Never thought about this before, but you ever think about what his parents went through, this particular man? We always think about this man, but we don't consider the story behind the story of the emotions that maybe were running through his parents' mind when this child was born. He was born blind, and his parents had given birth to this blind child. And what did they think then when they brought this child into this world that is full of vivid colors? Full of hues and shapes and motion and movement, full of different gradients. The beauty that we see around us in nature, this man never had the opportunity to see for years. And he was brought into a world that was built for sight. And he didn't see any of it. He never had that opportunity for years. And how his parents must have thought to themselves, well, what kind of life was he going to grow up and have? Being blind. I mean, this child would never see his parents' face, neither his mother or his father. He would never see the smiles on his parents' face. Wouldn't see the giggles or the laughters of his siblings that he had. These are things that he would miss out on. And this growing boy, who was a man now, was not going to be able to run around and play with other boys in his culture because he was blind. He couldn't go out and get a job. He couldn't support a family. These are all the things that he had missed out on for all of these years. And is it possible that his parents even wondered in themselves, was there something that they did wrong, that they sinned against God to bring out this condition in him? I mean, we see the question asked, who did sin? This was a common idea that they thought in that day. This man was born blind in a world that was built for sight. And this world is built for seeing. And for all of his childhood, he was left in darkness and he could see nothing. These are the things that I never really thought about before, but I see it now in this story. But God had orchestrated all of this, and he knew all the suffering that was going on in this man's life and in the life of his parents at this time. But God orchestrated the events of his life, and to that point that one day God himself was going to come up to this man, and he was going to touch him. And he was going to release him from the bondage that he had been in for so many years. He was going to release him from the captivity that he was held in his blindness. For what? What does it say? To show the works of God in him. We always point back to God. Always to the glory of God. For 20 to 30 years, he had been waiting for freedom to come. Surely he must have heard about the stories. He must have heard about the coming Messiah who would open the eyes of the blind. And he thought to himself, maybe this would be me one day. Maybe I would have that opportunity. But after so many years, maybe he thought, well, this wasn't going to happen. He had heard the prophets of old speaking about this. Maybe there was some flicker in his heart that this would happen. But it had been so long, and possibly he buried it. But unbeknownst to him, God had a plan for this man, and his story was going to be canonized for us to read today so that we can learn a purpose out of this. And with his healing, God is showing that we are the instruments of his mighty orchestra, and that his will is to be accomplished in a way that he chooses at his time in his divine purpose and plan. And this is really partly what was happening here in Exodus chapter 14. We're gonna use Exodus 14 as our linchpin. This is gonna be our base, and then we'll kind of feed off of that from time to time. So just make sure you hold your place in Exodus chapter 14. But we see in verse 3 that God continues speaking to Moses. And in verse 3 it says, "For Pharaoh will say to the children of Israel, 'They are bewildered by the land, the wilderness has closed them in.' Then I will harden the Pharaoh's heart so that he will pursue them, and I will gain honor over Pharaoh and all of his army, that the Egyptians may know that I am the Lord." And so all of these things, brethren, were written down, not just for that time. The blind man healing was not for the glory of God to be revealed just to them who were there at that time. This wasn't just for them. It was for the whole world to understand and to know, to hear this story. It was for everyone who would read the story that they would have this testimony written down for us to know, as we see here today, even in this story of the Exodus. I'd like to illustrate this point a little bit further, and you don't need to turn there, because I'm going to read out of the New Living Translation. This is Romans chapter 19. Paul is quoting Exodus chapter 9 and verse 16 here in Romans 9. He says this, and this is out of the Living Translation. He says, "Pharaoh, king of Egypt, was an example of this fact, for God told him he had given him the kingdom of Israel for the very purpose of displaying the awesome power of God against him." Well, that's remarkable. So that what? All the world would hear about God's glorious name. And of course, all the world did hear about it. For centuries, even at that time, the world around them had heard about this. The Philistines, the Amorites, they were afraid of the God that fought for Israel. And so this is the first thing that we have to realize, that everything first points to God, and that sometimes it's really not all about us. We're graced to be a part of his plan, and we're simply the clay of the maker that he's molding and he's shaping us to be his unique sculpture. Now, Pharaoh was told about the location of the Israelites and how they were trapped. And then he regretted letting Israel go. He regretted it, and he hardened his heart, just as God said he was going to do. And so he got together his choice chariots and his top fighting force, and he went after them. Josephus tells us that besides them, Pharaoh also took 50,000 horsemen and 200,000 foot soldiers. Now, if you can trust Josephus, that's staggering. That's an amazing army that is marching after you. The size of this army, and if you were Israel at this time, if you were put in the camp of Israel and you saw this coming down on you, you're not a fighting force. You're not an army. This is not what you were leaving Israel. You wanted to get away from them, and now you see them coming back towards you. What are your thoughts? How would you react if you thought about yourself in this position? What would you do? Let's see how Israel reacted here in Exodus 14, and look at verse 9. "So the Egyptians pursued them, all the horses and the chariots of Pharaoh, his horsemen and his army, and overtook them camping by the sea beside Pihahiroth before Baal-Zephon. And when Pharaoh drew near, the children of Israel lifted their eyes." And I want you to note that phrase. They lifted their eyes. "And behold, the Egyptians marched after them, so they were afraid. And the children of Israel cried out to the Eternal." Principle number two is this. Fear is a byproduct of faithlessness. Fear is a byproduct of faithlessness. You can hold your place here and turn over to Matthew chapter 14 if you like. Matthew chapter 14. Notice that the children of Israel lifted their eyes and they were afraid. You know, living in a world of sight is sometimes difficult because of the things that our eyes do see. Because of what we do see, they can deceive us. They can deceive us. They can tell us that what is in front of us is going to overtake us. They can, you know, tell us that what's behind us is going to grab us and steal us away. That there's no way out. And our eyes tell us this. Our eyes tell us that we function in a universe by ourselves alone with no divine hand to catch us. Because we don't see the invisible. We don't see that. And we don't see the divine hand that is there to strengthen us, that is there to protect us when we walk simply by sight. But in Matthew chapter 14, we see this incredible story, this famous story of where Jesus came to his disciples walking on water. And remember, Peter had asked if he could come out to join him on that water. And, you know, we hear this story so many times, and I've heard it so many times growing up, and I sometimes think to myself, yeah, Peter walked on water, and you just kind of go right on. This is a big deal. This is a very big deal that Jesus walked on water as a flesh and blood individual, but that Peter walked on water as well. The defiance of physics that had to take place here. This is remarkable. I mean, the reason that I'm standing here and you're sitting there and I'm not going through the floor is because we have forces here keeping us here. I mean, one force is stronger than gravity. This electrostatic force is keeping the molecules together so we don't just go right through the floor. So in some way, God had made the forces stronger so that water could hold him up or made him lighter or something. He did something. We don't know how it had worked, but God had done something to the forces to allow him to walk on that water. But he began to sink. Remember, he began to sink. But why did Peter begin to sink? Why did he begin to sink? Was it something about the electrostatic forces? All of a sudden they came apart? Well, we see here in Matthew 14, verse 30, why. But when he saw, so he looked, when he saw the wind boisterous, he looked around him, he saw the elements around him, he thought, this isn't normal, I shouldn't be able to do this, why am I here? And he was afraid. This is the same thing that we saw with ancient Israel. And immediately he began to sink, and he cried, saying, Lord, save me. And immediately Jesus stretched out his hand and caught him and said to him, oh, you of little faith, why did you doubt? Faithlessness leading to fear. Fear is our enemy. Faithlessness is believing that God is not sovereign in our lives, believing that he doesn't have total control over the events in our lives that take place. And when we take our eyes off the captain of our salvation, which is Jesus Christ, who is there that's left to save us? Who is there that's left? There's no one. Do we have ourselves? Are we the ones we've been waiting for? We don't save ourselves, but in the face of adversity with fear, we have this tendency to walk by sight and not by faith. There is so much more in life, brethren, to be joyful over than there is to be afraid of. And fear can compound and spin and grow exponentially if we let it. And it will get out of control. And if we let fear take a hold of us, it will grow and it will roll and it will move and it will build and it will get larger and it will consume our every thought. On a daily basis, fear can do that. And we can make mountains out of molehills with fear. It's not just for misunderstandings. Fear can do this to us. We can set up many barriers to listen to and to believe what God tells us in the pages of his Bible. That would be an easy way to talk ourselves right into the life of fatalism if we don't believe what we're reading. Well, this is just what I've been dealt in this life, and if this is the suffering that I've got to deal with, then I'll just deal with this suffering. That's fatalism. That's a Buddhist idea. That's a Gnostic idea, actually, too. Whatever I've been dealt, I've been dealt it, and I'll just suffer. And I'll sit here in my suffering. What a dark world that is to live in. But if we look back at what Israel went through and what they had just gone through in leaving Egypt, it's miraculous. But despite the 10 miraculous plagues that had occurred in Egypt just days earlier, ending with the death of the firstborn in the land, Israel had looked with their eyes. And they took their eyes off their leader, Moses, who was a type of Christ. Moses was a type of God. Even it says to the elders, he was a type of God to Aaron. And as he said, he will be a type of God to Pharaoh as well. And so they took their eyes off of off their salvation. And when they took their eyes off of Christ, they feared. And they feared man instead of fearing God due to their lack of faith. They didn't believe that God could save them, or maybe even would save them from what they thought was going to happen. Now, when we look at this story here, this is a physical example that sets for us a spiritual purpose. God could have allowed them to be killed, but we wouldn't have had this example here if that had happened. God wasn't going to allow them to be killed. The point here is that this is a spiritual example of being overtaken in spiritual death. God is not going to allow that to happen. So even though they were looking to God to be saved physically, our example is that we look to God to be saved spiritually. Because there are many examples that we see in the Bible. We don't have time, but you can think about Revelation chapter 2, for instance, and you think about what Christ had written to the church at Smyrna, and how he said, you will endure persecution for 10 days under the, basically we understand this is under the rule of Diocletian. And there were many Christians who were killed, and they lost their lives, and they were persecuted unto death. God doesn't necessarily spare our physical lives in tribulation, but he does spare us from sin. He does keep us from that if we are willing. And that's the point that he's trying to make here. If you think about, I would imagine most people here read the Drudge Report, at least look at it from time to time. You read the Drudge Report or maybe even Zero Hedge if you read that, a lot of economic news. You can read those things and you can think the sky is falling today. You can think that the world is coming to an end, that it's all going to come crashing down around us right now. We read these things, and it's disconcerting to see what's going on. But brethren, there is nothing that we can do about it. There's absolutely nothing that we can do about it. Not one thing. Now, this doesn't mean that we shouldn't watch world events. We have to be prudent, and we have to plan and watch for things, as God says, but to sit there and wring our hands over the next story that comes out on the Drudge Report or Zero Hedge is futile. It's futile. And it could all come crashing down tomorrow. I don't think it will, but if it does, God is still on his throne. He is still there, and he still knows what's happening. And since everyone here is human, and we all have similar human emotions, we're all similar in that way. I know you've been there before. I've been there before too, where we have these worries and we have these doubts about something that seems so important to us, something that we're going through that we think, well, how am I going to come out on the other side of this intact? How am I going to be able to make it through this? We didn't think it was possible that somehow we were going to come out and be okay. When you're a youth and you have a prom date, and you're going to go to the prom on Saturday night, and you get the biggest pimple in the world on your nose, it is the end of the world. It is literally, it's the end of the world. But as you get older, and you get a couple pimples on your nose, it's no big deal. So what? They'll go away. But things in life escalate. They can get worse. Much worse than when you're a youth or a teenager. There are things worse than pimples. There are things that are more important, things that will affect us even more. Let me just speak personally here for a minute. There was a time a couple of years ago where I thought maybe I was going to go out of business. And maybe some of you have been there before, and maybe you actually have gone out of business. I don't know. But it's a terrible thought to think that your livelihood will disappear overnight, and maybe that will be the end of that, and you're going to think, you think to yourself, you run, these things run through your head, and you think, well, how am I going to make the next payment for my insurance? How am I going to make my house payment? Where am I going to live? Because I'll probably be kicked out of my house. How am I going to pay for the food, the clothing of my kids? All of these things kind of run through your head, and maybe you've lived from paycheck to paycheck, and you've worried about these things. And years ago, I know that people, and it doesn't happen so much today, but you told your employer, I can't work on the Sabbath. And you lost your job. And you wondered, well, how am I going to make it? But God was always there, and he always came through, and we always made it out on the other side just fine. So far, I'm still in business, and that's great. There's always this I suppose a running joke amongst business owners, you come up to ask you if you're a business owner and they say, well, how was your last quarter? And you say, well, last quarter was okay. I'm not sure about the next quarter though. And the next quarter they come up to you and ask you, how was your last quarter? Last quarter was okay. I'm not sure about the next quarter. And it's like that over and over again. It's wash, rinse, and repeat. Because you're always not sure about what's going to happen and what's coming down the pipe there in the future. You know, when you're given a child with a birth defect and you think, oh, what am I going to do about this? There is a lot of fear that can overtake you. And brethren, you've been through similar things and even worse things that have happened. But there's a lot of fear that you can live in life if you let it. If you let fear take hold, and I've learned this personally, that fear can take hold of your life every single day. And it's very difficult to live when you're completely in fear and worried about things that may or may not happen. You just don't know. You know, our daughter Faith was given her name for a very special purpose. I mean, number one, we believe that God would heal her. And we do believe that. And it hasn't come yet, but we do believe that sometime it will happen. It will happen when God is ready for His purpose, for His will. And that will happen for everybody who has some sort of problem that they are dealing with. God will heal all of those people that are sick and hurting. But she also has her name, too, to remind us that we live from faith to faith every single day. And that's what God says to us, from faith to faith. We live from one faith to the next, and it's a springboard to the next to help us as we move toward His kingdom. There are always challenges that will come. Today, tomorrow, there will be something there. There will be something there next week, and we'll have to deal with it. But we have to know that God is always there. He is always there. Just as He saw Nathanael under the fig tree, He said, just as He sees every sparrow fall from the sky, these worthless birds, they fall, but He knows it. He knows when you have need of Him. And we can't lift our eyes like the children of Israel to look and see what is going on around us and react to those things that we see around us. We can't live our lives in fear of what may come. We can't live our lives in fear of the unknown. At times, brethren, there's going to be mountains on your side, and there's going to be a sea in front of you, and you're going to feel like there is an enemy breathing down your neck. You're going to feel evil behind you. You're going to feel that. But know that God is your rear guard, He says. That cloud and that pillar were behind them. And sometimes it may feel suffocating. But God is there. And God is with you. And we can't blame God for these things either. We can't blame God for the trials that we go through, for the sufferings that we have. I mean, you think about this man who was blind from birth again, and you consider this man who had gone through these things. And what did it say about him? It said, so that the works of God may be made manifest in him. What did this man say to Jesus after he was healed? Did he go up to him and say, hey, thanks a lot for giving me no sight for 30 years. Thanks a lot. I appreciate that. I missed all my childhood. I grew up, didn't have anything, that I couldn't see anything. 30 years you put me through this. Is that what he said? He didn't say anything of the sort. He didn't say anything like that. He didn't say that God was the reason he was blind. He came to an understanding of who God was, if you read through that section of Scripture. He came to an understanding that Jesus was the Son of God. And we see that progression takes place. And when something didn't go Israel's way, they complained and they whined and they murmured to God and they blamed Moses. Which means they were blaming God. And it's no different than Israel rejecting Samuel and rejecting God for rejecting him. Oh, brethren, we cannot let this happen to us. We can't become bitter in this way. There is much to be afraid of in this life if we allow it. And this festering can only take us away from the love that exists in the bosom of God. It only exists there. He's their ultimate place of comfort and security. But if we can't find comfort, and we don't allow ourselves to find comfort in the bosom of God, where do we find it? We find it in the bosom of the enemy. That's where we'll tend to go, to the bosom of the enemy. Which is principle number three. Faithless people return to the bosom of sin. Faithless people return to the bosom of sin. Notice again in Exodus chapter 14 and verse 11. And then they said to Moses, because there were no graves in Egypt, have you taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you so dealt with us to bring us out of Egypt? So once these trials came upon them, they wanted to go back to Egypt. They wanted to go back to slavery because they were scared of the faith that was required to save them. And they were more fearful of the enemy who was behind them than the God that was before them. To make this connection, brethren, with us, we think about this and we put ourselves in the spiritual place here of Israel. As we make our dash across the desert, just as Israel did, to leave sin, okay? We have to be careful not to become fearful of what we see as the apparent bad consequences of leaving sin. Sometimes we can think about, I should say this. Sometimes it seems there are bad consequences in leaving sin. Just as Israel had dashed across the desert to leave the spiritual sin center, we cross. Oftentimes it feels like a barrenness when we try to leave a sin behind us that we're leaving. And there's almost as if there is this barrenness that exists as you're leaving it. You're leaving this comfortable place in many respects, this culture of sin, this metropolis as Egypt was, and we've sat by the Nile and we've dipped our feet in that Nile. We've all experienced the pleasures of that in times past. But as we leave it and we try to escape it, there's this barrenness around it that sin sort of engulfs, and we think, this isn't very comfortable being out here, and I don't see anything good out there. Maybe it's better just to go back to Egypt again. And sometimes it feels like these are bad things. It doesn't feel comfortable. And these are what I call the consequences of leaving sin, because we go to what feels like a barren place. And we feel like we've got to get back to some place that's comfortable. You know, sin has the intent that it has to keep us at its center where it seems it's comfortable. Who wants to go dwell in the desert? Even for a short period of time, when you've got all the comforts back in Egypt. And when we leave sin, sometimes it takes a period of time to escape. Not only do we have to leave the comfort, and I put that in quotes, air quotes, comfort of what it seems it is, but we have to get through the wilderness at the edge of sin where we begin to see the consequences. And again, consequences are simply the result of an action. It doesn't matter if it's good or bad. It's just the consequences of it. And so as Israel looked at the ill consequences of leaving sin, they feared. That is, they saw Pharaoh and his armies coming after them because they were fleeing his bondage and his subjugation. And the ill consequences to them was that they were going to die. That's what they thought. That's what they felt as a result of their rebellion against the forces of sin. Now, how does this apply spiritually? In like manner, as we abandon sin, Satan and his armies breathe down our neck because he wants us back. He's that roaring lion, and he wants us back for himself. Remember when Moses had approached Pharaoh early on in the story in Exodus chapter 8 and verse 28? He had approached him very early on, and Pharaoh said this. He said, I will let you go that you may sacrifice to the Lord your God in the wilderness. Only, don't go very far away. Just go a little ways. And then come right back. I'll let you go out there, but come right back. And then in Exodus chapter 10, Pharaoh says, the men can go, but all the children, women, and the flocks have to stay. They can't go. You see, Satan always wants to keep us. He wants to keep us here, or there in sin. He wants to keep something that is valuable to us. He's okay with his captives wandering into the desert every now and again to see what's out there, that barrenness to try and escape. He's okay with that, but he wants something valuable, something that he can hold that will bring us back into his clutches, into the bosom of sin. Satan wants to console us in his bosom, and yet it's a false consolation. Hold your place here, and I'd like you to turn to 2 Corinthians chapter 10. 2 Corinthians chapter 10. Paul writes something about the battle that we go through on a regular basis. And of course, we know that we don't battle against flesh and blood, but against spiritual forces and wickedness in high places. But Paul writes here in 2 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 3, he says, For though we walk in the flesh, we do not war, and I think it's best rendered, according to the flesh. We do not war according to the flesh. Meaning that we don't battle as flesh battles. We don't battle a physical warfare. Yes, the flesh is weak, and that's a limitation to our battles at times, but our battles are truly spiritual in nature. 2 Corinthians 10 and verse 4, for the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty through God to the pulling down of strongholds, casting down imaginations and every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God, and bringing into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ. These strongholds are obstacles that in many cases have been set up in our mind that are tied back to sin. They're tied back to Egypt. They're tied back to the sinful nature. They're tied back to bondage. And they recall Egypt in our mind. They bring us back to the metropolis of sin, where we can sit and bathe in the Nile once again. Pharaoh said, sure, go worship, and then come back. That's okay. Moses knew they couldn't do that. They couldn't hang around there. They had to be completely free of Egypt. They had to be completely away from it. Worshiping and then coming back would simply entangle them again. The strongholds are still there. They wouldn't break any of them down. You know, brethren, oftentimes when we feel that we're at our strongest spiritually, we are often at our weakest. What I mean to say is that spiritual failures come more often in life when we feel good about our lives spiritually. Success has a way of deceiving us and lulling us to let our guard down. Success, I believe, has destroyed more lives than failure ever could. You know this intuitively. You think about life in general. And let me give you just a simple example. Maybe you've tried to change your diet. I think we all at some point have tried to change our diet. We've tried to lose weight or tried to change something about our eating habits. And we've done pretty good. Maybe we've done pretty good for 2 or 3 or 4 weeks, something of that nature. And doing pretty good. I'll just take a couple days off. And you go out and buy that box of Twinkies and you eat one. And two, and then grab the ho-hos, and you eat three, and four, and it just keeps on a-coming. And it just, you know, you can't stop. And before you know it, you've eaten all of this stuff, and cookies, and everything else, and oh, it's so good. It tastes so good. And it throws you into this downward spiral again, all because you felt so good about yourself. I can't imagine anybody. Has anybody gone? No, I'm not asking. This is what I'm talking about. There are times that we have thought or we felt that we're on top of the world. And we may have our Bible study down. And we may have our prayer life down. And we may be actually fasting pretty regularly. Things are going really well. And then maybe we get a little bit hurried one day and we think, well, I've been doing pretty good. I don't have time. I won't pray today, or I won't study the scriptures. Or maybe you stayed up too late one night and you thought, I'll be okay. I won't have to deal with that right now, and I'll get it later. And what happens is it spirals out of control. and the day doesn't go just right. And then you get hurried and you put something off. And the next thing you know, that night I don't have time to pray and I don't have time to study anything. And it just spirals out of control. All because you thought, doing pretty good. I'm doing pretty good in life. These are the things that I'm talking about. We fall into sin because we've lost our connection with God. Something happens. We don't quite have that strength to overcome it. Because we're on top of the world spiritually. That's why this sort of thing happened. The Bible is filled with examples of spiritual lapses. When we're on top of the world spiritually. In fact, if you hold your spot, so hold your spot in Exodus 14 and hold your spot here, okay, because we're going to come right back. And I'd like you to turn just back to 1 Corinthians 10, just one book back over. And look at 1 Corinthians 10, because Paul specifically addresses this very thing that I'm talking about here. But he addresses it in terms of the Israelites. And he uses them as an example of what I'm saying. So in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, he says this in verse 6. Now these things were our examples to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted. Neither be you idolaters, if some of them were, as it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. Neither let us commit fornication, as some of them committed and fell in one day 23,000. Neither let us tempt Christ, as some of them also tempted and were destroyed of serpents. Neither murmur, as some of them have murmured and were destroyed of the destroyer. Now all of these things happened unto them for examples, and they are written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the world are come. See, he's writing to us. He's writing to the church here. He's writing to you and me. Verse 12, he says, therefore, let him who thinks he stands take heed, lest he fall. What a high Israel was on after they left Egypt. Even after Pharaoh's armies were destroyed, they left Egypt with a high hand, it says. How great they felt, but how quickly did they fall? Look back again at 2 Corinthians chapter 10. 2 Corinthians chapter 10, and now we're down in verse 6. We had read verse 5, and let's look at verse 6. And having in a readiness to revenge all disobedience when your obedience is fulfilled. Now what is he saying here? What he means to say is that when we are at our high spiritually, what do we do? What are we supposed to do? We've cast down the strongholds to get there. We've brought those evil and deceptive and adulterous thoughts into the captivity of Christ. And we've done those things that we should do. And we've sacrificed to the Lord. Then our obedience has been fulfilled. Then it's fulfilled. Then don't take time to celebrate that. Don't go back to Egypt and gloat in its face. Look what I did. How wonderful I am now. Paul says, be ready now. Now that you've done those things, be ready now to revenge all disobedience. In other words, remain faithful in the bosom where true comfort exists. Where true comfort exists for eternity and not for a season. Which leads us to principle number four. Principle number four. Sin is attractive and comfortable in the short term. Sin is attractive and comfortable in the short term. Eventually, it doesn't become that way, and I'll explain that in a minute. And we really only already touched on this point a little bit, but I want to just explore this just a bit more. Exodus chapter 14 again, let's read on in verse 12. He says, is this not the word that we told you in Egypt, saying, let us alone that we may serve the Egyptians? For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than we should die in the wilderness. You know, lots of times when God calls us and we're confronted with difficulties and problems, we may begin to think the same thing, because the world is nice and it's comfortable and it's modern and it has everything that is available for us. And sometimes we don't understand or even forget that when God begins to work with us and continues to work with us, that He will put us through fiery trials to perfect us. as Mr. McAlexander was talking about, to purify our character. What would it be like today to be thrust into the wilderness? If we were thrust into the wilderness as they were, and we can't take our smartphones, and we don't have the internet, we don't have all of our platforms that we're connected to, it would be a harsh withdrawal, wouldn't it? I mean, studies show that there are addictions to these things. That if you haven't logged in on the internet or Facebook or whatever platform it is for a certain period of time, that people actually go through withdrawal patterns because there's an actual addiction that's taken place. Do you know there was a recent study that showed that 5% of all couples check their Facebook during sex? Yeah, I said that right. God has... Now you're going to think about that. It is staggering. But that's the addiction that takes place. God had promised here to deliver His people. He planned to redeem them from the clutches of sinful Egypt, from the bondage that had oppressed them for so many years. And once faced with a trial, they cried out that bondage was better than freedom. And they would rather die slaves than die free. How staggering it is. Not that they were going to die. Not that this was going to happen. They were on the edge of freedom, and yet they were this proverbial dog that returns to its own vomit and the sow that returns to its wallowing in the mire. Sin was attractive, and sin was very comfortable for them. And it was difficult to escape. And this is very important for us today. You know, when we get sucked into a sin, whatever it may be, initially it's pleasurable. I don't know why else we would do it. It seems pleasurable, at least. There's something about it that looks attractive. When Eve took of that fruit of the tree, she thought it looked good for food. It looked good, even though it wasn't to eat. And then we recognize how evil it is. At least we hope we do at some point. And we make that dash across the desert, just as Israel did. And then we get to the sea and we're trapped. What do? We've got the mountains on either side of us. We've got now the sea in front of us, and we're in apparent dead end with sin trailing at our back. And all of a sudden, it seems pretty good to go back to Egypt again. That sin looks pretty good again, and so we go back into the bondage that we were in before. And sometimes it's hard to break out of a sin. That taskmaster seems more comfortable, even though it isn't. And so we dash across again, and we do this in many cases over and over again, trying to get away from some particular sin. And to the point where we finally say, you know what? No matter what happens, I'm going to not go back. We don't fear what is going to happen. We don't fear the things that we feel are going to come upon us. And they may. But we don't fear those consequences of leaving sin behind us anymore. When we lose that fear with the help of Christ in us, it's at that point at which the faith of Christ can take over in our lives, and we don't want to return back. We fight it with everything we have. There's any impulse, it's repugnant. There's not that desire to go back because, well, I think a couple of reasons. Number one, there's a way out now. We see it. There was always a way out, but now we see that way out. And God provides a way of escape that we don't have the opportunity to go back. But at that point, we have the mind of Christ in us. And secondly, sin is not attractive anymore. It doesn't become attractive to us, and we're delivered by God in us. Look at Exodus chapter 14 and verse 13. And Moses said to the people, "Do not be afraid. Stand still and see the salvation of the Lord, which He will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you shall see no more, or you shall see again no more forever." Forever. You will never see them again. This is us leaving sin. We will never see it again. And the Lord will fight for you, and you shall hold your peace. And the Lord said to Moses, "Tell the children of Israel to go forward." Tell the children of Israel to go forward. Brethren, this is what I see as the theme of the last day of unleavened bread. Go forward. That's what we are to do from here. God has promised to deliver. He promised to deliver them, and now he was going to deliver in a very big way, in a spectacular way. He was going to strike at the heart of the evil one. And look at verse 21. Down to verse 21, it says, "Then Moses stretched out his hands over the sea, and the Lord caused the sea to go back by a strong east wind all that night, and made the sea into dry land, and the waters were divided. And so the children of Israel went into the midst of the sea on the dry land, and the waters were a wall to them on their right hand and on their left." What an amazing thing this was, would be to see, to actually be there, and how awesome to be able to see that and to go down into the dry land and to see the waters piled up on both sides of you as you walk down in there. What a remarkable thing to experience. As we draw to a close here this morning in a few minutes, and I've got just a few more things, I want to briefly look at how this command to go forward applies to us. I want to first look at ancient Israel here. God made this miraculous way of escape for them. The waters were piled up and all Israel went into the sea, and in so doing, all Israel was baptized into Moses, which, of course, Moses was a type of Christ, and they all passed through the sea. And 1 Corinthians 10 actually tells us this. They were all baptized into Moses. And brethren, this is the way that it had to happen. There was no other way that this could have happened for them to wholly and completely leave Egypt. In order to truly be free from slavery and Pharaoh, they had to pass through the sea. They had to do this. They had to be buried. They had to be raised on the other side to give us this type of what we need to do to leave sin and slavery. That was what this was all about. To show us the way to escape death and sin. There was no other way to occur for this to occur. To show us how Christ saves us from sin. Yes, we put out sin to show us how Christ saves us from sin and from bondage and from death. They had to be cleansed from their captors, and the sea had to cover up their enemies. And this is really remarkable when you think about this. This example gives us a very important spiritual lesson, and that is our only escape from sin is through our death in Jesus Christ. That's the only way out. When we lose our life, then we save it. And once we have repented of our sins and we're on the edge of leaving sin, God says what? He says, go forward. Go forward, my brethren. You know, if you're not baptized yet and you're on the edge, he says, go forward. Repent and be baptized for the remission of sins. And for those of us that are baptized, the lesson still exists today that we must continue forward, always being cleansed on a daily basis, regularly by the Word of God. Don't hang around the edge of sin. Get away. Go forward. Progress to the kingdom. Make that trek and live a life worthy now of the repentance that God has granted to us. And don't become weary in well-doing and have a readiness to revenge all disobedience. And implicit within this, brethren, is that just as the Israelites were buried by the sea, they were raised in newness of life on the other side, just as we are raised in newness of life from the watery grave of baptism. And then they began that long trek toward the promised land, as we are doing toward our promised land of the kingdom of God. But though Christ's death offers a way out of sin for us, it is his life actually that saves us. It's his life that promises a continuance in the salvation to receive the gift of the promised land and eternal life. And so with this admonition to go forward, it's only because of his resurrection. Only because of his resurrection that we are afforded that opportunity to do something beyond the grave. And that resurrection happened during these days of unleavened bread. Otherwise, we'd be right back there where we started in Egypt. When the vessel is cleaned, put something in it. Fill it with righteousness, else it becomes filled with darkness again. It's because of his resurrection that these things occur. It's because of his resurrection that we are able to go forward and we don't go backward. The sign out here says on this church, Christ is risen. Indeed he has. He rules during these days, not on Easter Sunday morning, like they think. But he rose after 3 days and three nights in the grave. I'd like to read to you Romans chapter 6 from the Living Translation again. Romans chapter 6 and verse 1 through 7. I'll just read this. He says, verse 1, he says, "Well then, should we keep on sinning so that God can show us more and more kindness and forgiveness? Of course not. Since we have died to sin, how can we continue to live in it? Or have you forgotten that when we became Christians and were baptized to become one with Jesus Christ, we died with him? For we died and were buried with Christ by baptism, and just as Christ was raised from the dead by the glorious power of the Father, we also may live new lives. Why? Because of his resurrection. Since we have been united with him in death, we will also be raised as he was. Our old sinful selves were crucified with Christ so that sin might lose its power. And in our lives, we are no longer slaves to sin. We don't have that bondage to fear any longer. We don't have the fear or the faithlessness that we now can trust God utterly and completely. So within these days, brother, not as only the death of Christ pictures, but also his resurrection. As it had to have been a topic during that first year, where they're in 31 AD when Christ was resurrected. They had to be discussing this on the last day even. So the lesson for us today is that we must go forward from here and continue to go forward until we reach the internal habitation of the kingdom of God. And finally, I have one more scripture to read before I close. There is yet a future time. And I would be remiss if I didn't cover this. But there's yet a future time when this same scenario that occurred more than 3,400 years ago will occur again. And it's in Isaiah chapter 11. In Isaiah chapter 11, God will once again bring his people out of slavery. He will once again bring his people out of captivity, and he will deliver them with the same might and the same power with which he delivered Israel so long ago. Isaiah chapter 11 and verse 11, it says, "It shall come to pass in that day that the Lord shall set his hand again the second time to recover the remnant of his people who are left from Assyria and Egypt, from Pathros and Cush, from Elam and Shinar, from Hamath and the islands of the sea. He will set up a banner for the nations and will assemble the outcasts of Israel and gather together the dispersed of Judah from the four corners of the earth." And in verse 15, "The Lord will utterly destroy," or he'll dry up, "the tongue of the sea of Egypt. With his mighty wind, he will shake his fist over the river Euphrates and strike it into seven streams and make men cross over a dry shod. And there will be a highway for the remnant of his people who will be left from Syria, as it was for Israel in the day that he came up from the land of Egypt." What a beautiful picture of this last day of unleavened bread. The culmination of bringing all of his people out of sin and slavery by means of passing under the water and baptism. Starting with the redemptive antitype that began with ancient Israel and continuing with those that are progressing towards baptism today, and also showing the continual cleansing that occurs for those who have been baptized. And then ending with this glorious future time when God will bring back the remnant of Israel. And he will bring them back to his bosom out of captivity and out of slavery through another exodus through the sea. What a marvelous day this is. What a wonderful day to let us remember God's admonition to the children of Israel so long ago, as it's the same admonition for us today. My brethren, go forward.